Welcome to the Mary Mack Show, where we will be talking about your feelings, experiences, and pain following the death of a loved one. Hello, my friends, my warriors. This is Mary Mack of The Mary Mack Show. I am privileged today to have Kim Grunberg with me. She unfortunately lost her son, Sean, in 2019. It's actually September 12th. And he is also survived by his father, Dan, his sister, Amanda, and his stepbrother, Kason. I'm grateful that she's with me. She started a wonderful organization known as Dancing with Our Angels. And we're going to take some time today to talk about Sean, his life, his death, what happened with the case, and also her advocacy work, which she has completely dove into over all these many years. So I thank you, Kim, for being with me today. And I appreciate that you take the time.
Thank you so much for having me and for creating a space to talk about this.
Absolutely. And Kim lives in Salem, Oregon. And Sean also used to live in Bend. Is that correct?
Yes.
Bend, Oregon. And so for those of us who are not Northwesterners, please tell us what life was like raising Sean in that vicinity.
No. This is a beautiful part of the country. Bend is in the center of Oregon, and it's a high desert. So it has the juniper and the sagebrush and the big mountains, you know, snow-capped mountains, beautiful sunsets, rivers, forests, a lot of outdoor recreation. It's a beautiful place to raise children. Considered a safe place to raise children in those days. He had a great childhood. He really did. We spent a lot of time. Sean's favorite thing to do besides video gaming was to spend time with his father fishing in the high Cascade Lakes. And they would, you know, spend nights out there under the stars and fishing early in the morning. And that was a common thing that he did growing up. And he, one other thing that he did, his dad is a hobbyist, astrophotographer. That's a big word.
Wow.
So Sean was extremely intelligent. And one of the things that he really loved to do was stay up all night with Dad and take pictures of the moon and the galaxies. And he was very fascinated with outer space and taking these amazing, they really take amazing photos. But if you tell them that, they, you know, are a little shy about that. But yeah,
there are pictures. I never knew anybody who did that. That's amazing.
Yeah. Sean's dad made sure that Sean had his own telescope and, you know, all the things that we do, right? And for Sean and I, Sean loved to read. And from a very early age, and Harry Potter came out about the time that Sean was learning to read. And that was actually his motivator to read. And so he just read these big books, you know, right away. And he was also a very good writer. And so Sean and I would often make up stories together. So I would say one line, then he would say the next one.
Oh, and my goodness.
Yeah. So he was a beautiful boy. He was charming and he was fun. And he was extremely shy outside of the house. like painfully shy. He didn't like to be in crowds, and we realized that he had a sensory issue. So he, even wearing buttons on his shirt, made his skin uncomfortable. And we were working all the time, and Sean was the baby of our family at that time, and we just adjusted accordingly. It didn't really dawn on us that something might be terribly wrong that we weren't dealing with. And it didn't get picked up by a pediatrician, anything like that. I think that's one of my big regrets looking back, is that I didn't realize how that shyness was really an inherited anxiety disorder. And the sensory issues were probably a sign that he needed some sort of help, in some way dealing with whatever was causing that. But we didn't realize that at the time. So school was challenging for Sean because having to sit in one space, and he wasn't hyperactive or attention deficit. But it was really hard to sit in that space where he felt so shy and uncomfortable, if that makes sense. And then one other thing is Sean was a bigger kid. And so he was bullied in elementary school by some people for that. And he wasn't real coordinated. And so in sports, he wasn't the best at that. But he could beat you at chess every time. Right. And in Central Oregon, can't speak for anywhere else in the country, but in Central Oregon, kids being involved in sports is kind of where you fit in.
I see.
Right. So I think that was his first kind of challenges were those things. He had one thing I really like to talk about when I talk about Sean is what I heard from his friends in the after he left. They said the thing about Sean is when you met Sean, you knew you met your best friend. And he
Oh,
was
that's
that
so
way
nice.
to all of them. And he would go around, because he was shy, he would go around the outside of the playground and kind of gather the kids on the outside of the playground. And they would be his friends, right? So he was really good at making groups of people who connected with him. And several people said in the after that Sean was the one I knew really cared about me and would have given me the shirt off of his back.
He seems like a very pure soul.
He was, yeah, he
Aww.
was.
And how is his relationship with his sister and brother?
Really good. Amanda is six, is Sean's sister, and she is 6 years older than Sean. So
Oh.
she was little mommy, right? When Sean came
As soon
along.
as he came.
Yeah. She was that perfect age to, be sure and tell him all the things that he needed to do and to take good care of him. So they, even with their age difference, they were very close. They were, very. They were always close during the time that Sean struggled with addiction. It was really hard, to be close. But when they grew up, they were really close. And then Kaysen is, let's see, about 6 years younger than Sean, and he's my stepson. And so it was Sean's turn to do the taking care of and showing the way. Kaysen, he did live with his mother, but he would come and visit, every week. And Sean even did some babysitting for Kaysen during the summertime. So Kaysen was pretty happy to have a big brother.
It's good
Yeah.
to have a pal.
Yes.
And Amanda being 6 years older, they were still close, though, it seems.
They were still really close.
It's funny, when my youngest brother was born, I was 6 years older than him, and
Oh.
it was the same thing. His crib was put in my room, and I was the one who woke up every, in the night and changed him. And when I
Oh.
look back and I think of it, it was so natural. I'm sure Amanda just felt it was natural. He's my baby now.
And she would ride bikes with him, and she really she took time to spend with him, and I think they really enjoyed each other. And and Sean thought the world of his sister. Like, he just, that was another thing in the, as people contact you who knew him, in the immediate following his death, people would always say he always talks so highly of his sister.
Oh,
So
that's so nice.
he really respected and admired her. And
How are
yeah.
they? How are his siblings doing since his death?
That's, see, well, since Sean's died, Amanda has gotten married. And so, yeah, and she, she's has all of her boxes checked. She's doing all the things that we want them to do, and she's really struggling. And there's, we have a hard time finding and a hard time participating in any kind of grief support for siblings.
Yes, it's usually that way, unfortunately.
Yeah, and as a parent, it's really hard to watch your ch child struggle and not be able to help. And we went through that with addiction, and now we're going through that with grief. It's hard. I mean, both kids are coping and appear to be thriving, and there's still a very broken place where Sean once was.
And how about you and Dan?
Sean was Dan's only child,
Oh, I see.
and so I think he's coping the best that he can. He's continuing to work. He's still, Dan owns a landscaping business in Bend, and Sean worked for him, and they put water features and beautiful landscapes in. And his dream was that Sean would take over that business one day. And so, and Dan's now, now doing that without Sean by his side. And that's got to be very hard.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you?
Me. Some days I'm okay now after 4 years. And some days I'm still, it still feels like day one.
Yeah.
Let's see. I'm really striving to, I got a new puppy, which seems like
His
a
or
riddle.
her, he or he, a girl or
Little girl. She's a little girl. And it seems like a random thing to bring up, but, and I love to take landscape video to go places and do video and put video together. And this little puppy has come into my life who needs to walk every day. And so I follow this puppy around and, videotape and put videos together. And I found great joy in that.
That's
And
wonderful.
when I found, I think I really needed somebody to kind of need me at this point in my life. I was feeling a little irrelevant, Amanda and Kason are both adults now
Oh,
and
okay.
living their lives. And I, this little puppy needed me. I mean, it needed me to be okay. It needed me to
Yes.
be up in the morning and ready to go.
That's
And
wonderful. What did you name her?
her name is Kimber.
Ah,
And so, in following puppy around and watching spring emerge in the beautiful Northwest, I was feeling, gosh, I'm doing really good. I'm feeling really good. And then recently I just had a crash and I'm like, I'm not okay. Like,
But
so I think.
sometimes that still happens, and it's the weirdest thing when, you don't even expect it. Something triggers it, and all of a sudden, boom, right? It's
Yeah.
hard.
It's a hard loss, and I don't, it's so hard to even describe the pain at losing that particular individual in our lives.
Yes.
Yeah. All the things, so.
I remember in the beginning as always a roller coaster, and then instead of it being so steep, then it kind of comes into waves,
Yes.
but there will always be something. You'll go into a store, you'll look at the, in our case, it was a girl, so you'll look at the little girl's, clothing. You happen to go by. Now you might have went past that section tons of times, but now you look at it and the first thing that you think to yourself is, I never have to go and buy anything in there anymore.
Yeah.
Or maybe not for a long time. And definitely not for her,
Yeah.
And those things would affect me. I would just, but I'm such a sensitive soul to begin with. So,
Yes. Me too. I do know. Yes.
oh my God,
Me.
I'm such a sensitive soul. And my honey always says that to me. But he's good in the respect that he will say, let it go. Don't hold it in,
Yeah.
And
Yeah,
I thank him for that. I'm grateful for that,
It is nice to have that. For me, it is Flaming Hot Cheetos. Nobody in our house eats Flaming Hot Cheetos. I saw a display. They did a huge display of them, and it dropped me. So I do understand
Did
that.
Sean used to have those with you?
Nobody in our house would eat them, just Sean, but he always had to have them. And it, like you said, just seeing the big display of them there instantly, I felt all those things you talked about. I would never buy those again. He would never be here for that. And the downhill spiral begins,
Yes.
pretty quickly.
Yeah. And that roller coaster can, just pop into you at any moment in time. And
Yes.
there's nothing you can do about it. And
Yeah.
there's nothing you really need to do about it. And for those of you who are listening who may not have experienced that yet, let us both tell you that it arrives at a moment's notice, right? And you're probably thinking, why are you laughing? Well, we're laughing because we're on the other side of it. Right? And but that's not to say that it's not going to come back. So if you find that that does happen and it drops you to the depths of despair, go home, roll in bed, get a nice hot cup of tea, and just let it wait it out. You just have to wait it out. And the one thing I think, Kim, you would agree about is that you cannot feel guilty for not being strong enough to go through that. You can't. You
It's
can't.
time. Yeah, it's time to be nice,
You're
nice to yourself. Yes.
be
And
kind to
just
yourself.
lean into that feeling, into that grief. Over time, we learn that we will. It will subside again, and we will be able to stand. We will be able to breathe again. That takes a long, quite a long time to learn,
Yes.
because when that happens in the beginning, it just feels like it's everything all over again. And it over time, we do learn to walk, even when it hurts.
Even when it's almost like being a baby, you get up, you fall, you get up, you fall, get up, you fall, right? And it takes a really long time to not feel like you have sea legs, It takes a really long time. And that's part of the grieving process, and we all go through it. And Just be kind to yourself, especially in the beginning. And you're going to find, as we've both found, and I think we should talk a little bit about this, on how people react to us
Oh, sure.
and how people, they don't really do right by us, either because they can't be bothered or because they're trying to do the right thing, but they don't know what to say, so they say stupid things.
Yes. Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So tell us about your experiences with that.
Wow, I've because Sean lost his life to substance use, which I know we'll get into, I have heard a number of stupid things. For me, how I've coped with hearing those things is remembering that it's not about me or about Sean. Sometimes the things people say has more to do with them. That is one of my coping mechanism when listening to things. Most often with me in, let's see, I have a huge support group. Let me start with that because the online grieving mothers groups have been a huge support for me, and I don't know if I would have made it without them. And so when somebody says something in the real world outside of, the support, you're able to go back there and everybody rallies around you in those spaces and kind of helps heal some of the things that people have said.
Very true.
I have heard, at least you have other children.
Oh, yes.
I've heard that one. I have
Wait.
heard.
Or if you're a younger mother, at least you could have more.
Yes. Well, I think,
That's gonna make a difference.
yeah, that's a really hard one to hear. That's a really hard one to not fight back. I think one of the hardest things for me that people do is if they hear that I've lost a child, they'll say, "How did he die? Like, what happened?" I said, "Well, Sean was struggling with drug use and he received a lethal dose of fentanyl and he died." And as soon as the substance use comes up, you get the look like,
Yes.
and it's
Oh.
all the judgment and the, you
Yep.
feel the empathy go, the scale
Away.
goes way down on that. Like,
Yep.
you can feel, you feel judged. You feel like your child doesn't have as much value, because of the substance use. That's a really hard one, for me.
Yes. And like you said, and the empathy all goes away. I think because in their head they're saying, well, my child, that would never happen to my child.
I had a lady say that to me. She said, "My kids would have never done that. They knew better."
Holy
And
Moses.
I was like, "Oh,
And
oh."
what's that there before the grace of God go I?
Thank you. Yes. Yes. Exactly.
It's people are strange sometimes.
They are. They are.
I mean, I can't. When Angela was killed, the thing was, well, why was she in those woods by herself? Well, because everybody took those woods to the store. It was no big deal. It became a big deal when somebody wanted to harm her. It became a big deal when the person who delivered something to your son did the wrong thing. That's when it became a big deal. Not because of what Sean decided to do with his life, his struggles, or anything.
Somebody made that choice for him. Yes.
That's right.
Yeah.
And, the judgment part. Even in homicide or suicide, it's the same thing.
Is it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They don't want to get involved. I mean, we've had situations where you're in the grocery store and a friend of yours, you see them come into the aisle and Then they see you, and then they skirt out and they go to the different aisle.
Oh, ouch, ouch, yeah.
And we're like, oh, that was interesting. But
I
I think
find
to
now,
myself, I'm sorry, go on.
no, I find now that people after the 4 years, I should be over it. I definitely shouldn't want to talk about him or bringing up his name maybe makes other people feel uncomfortable. Or my least favorite is when they say, when you talk about Sean, it makes me feel sad.
Sorry.
And so I shouldn't talk about it. And that probably is the most devastating thing that I hear. And I kind of want to say, if it makes you feel sad, imagine how I feel all the time.
Do you say that?
I don't, but I would like to. But I keep telling myself, educate, don't hate. Educate, don't hate. Remember, because
You
it is
want
so. Yeah,
to.
I want to.
I would want to too. Yes. Would you like to tell us about when? Well, tell us about a little bit about his struggles and how he got involved using.
Let's see. Sean was 17 when I learned that he was using heroin.
Whoa, that's heavy.
His sister had called me, Amanda had called me, and said that a friend of Sean's had got a hold of her and said, I need you to know Sean's using heroin. Now, at that time, Sean wasn't living in my house. He was living in his at his dad's house. He was just about ready to graduate from high school. And we had no idea. None of us had any idea.
How'd that make you feel? I mean, that's pretty big deal.
I was devastated. I was in shock. I didn't really believe it. I was shocked. I did not know that people did heroin where we lived.
Okay.
In my mind, because the kids belonged to they did the DARE program and all that stuff in school, and we talked about drugs and all of that. But I didn't have a big emphasis on it in my mind because it just seemed like something that wouldn't affect us. You
Right.
know, we were playing on the river and, through the woods and living life. When I heard that my son was addicted to heroin, I couldn't even wrap my head around the fact that that was even something he could get a hold of.
Right.
As you can probably imagine, by the time I heard that Sean was addicted to heroin, we had been years into addiction without me knowing it. And
Oh,
that was
really?
even when he was living in my house. I
And
didn't
what
know.
at what age do you think that started for him?
So I talked to Sean about that during his addiction. One time I just said to him, how did this, like, when did you start doing this? How did this start? And he said, Mom, I've been doing this for years. And he said that there were kids at school who had, prescriptions, and they were, at some point he was given some pill, to try with his friends. And he said when he was 10 years old, we were visiting the grandparents. One of the grandparents was going through cancer treatment and had Xanax, was there and not locked up. But we didn't think about it. My kids didn't get into stuff. I was that mom. My kids knew better than all the bad things. That was how I saw the world. But we had gone out to play basketball, and he took one of those Xanax, and he said it was the best family get together ever because he didn't feel the sensory stuff. He didn't feel the anxiety. He just felt normal. And so that started his pill use. And then when he couldn't get the pills anymore, he went to heroin. And so, this sweet little boy of mine, he was very young. He was in the 10 to 12 age group when it started. And I had no idea. One time the school called, and Sean had gotten in trouble for texting about the kids were going to meet up and smoke some pot. And this was in high school. And I was devastated at that. And in the back of my mind, I'm like, well, kids experiment and all of that. But I'm like, no, you're not going to be doing this, Sean. This is unacceptable. When I was scolding him for the marijuana and telling him how things were going to be, I had no idea that he was already addicted to pain pills and using heroin. Yeah.
And had you gotten to the place where you found out about his sensory issues?
No, he was never treated for his sensory issues. He was never treated for that, because by the time we realized that we had a problem, we already had a really big problem. Right. So he was in full-blown substance use by the time we knew. And he was using to not get sick at that point. And there is Oregon has one of the highest addiction rates in the country,
Oh, I didn't know that.
and we have one of the lowest access to treatment rates. So
Whoa.
when Sean would want to get help, it would be call every day for a bed, and he'd call every day for, 10 days one time, 20 days another time, and he would always relapse before he would get in. And then he would be, off back in the full cycle of addiction and all that is. And being very, he was a very sensitive, emotionally sensitive and physically, person living in drug addiction, you're exposed to a lot of trauma. And so each traumatic event would just lead to more and more use. He lost a girlfriend that he loved very much. She lost her life to addiction. And each just, I don't know, each thing that happened took him further down that road.
And when you have a trauma like that, you lose someone that you really love, and you're going through trauma, you're going through your own challenges, that's not easy.
So Sean's dad was in the forefront of Sean's active addiction years, because he lived there, and his dad was trying to convince him not to use and help him, find other solutions and help to get him try to get him into treatment. And I was more the when you're ready to stop doing what you're doing, I'm right here to help you. I didn't understand at that point still how addiction really works. I didn't understand the changes to the brain. I didn't understand what the body feels like and all of that. I really looked at substance use as a behavior. I really did. And I really have a lot of guilt over that. I really struggle with not knowing more than I knew at the time. I really thought it was a choice. And I think that attitude about it, wasn't beneficial for Sean.
But you can only know what you know at the time.
I think a lot of the advocacy type stuff that I participate in, what's so important to me is, stigma, erasing stigma is a big part. And just being out there, like this show, all of the events, when we went through it, I was really alone in it. I didn't know anybody else who was going through this. In my mind, it was only our child, and he had a behavioral issue. And I never thought that he would die from it. So when I hear people say it wouldn't be my child, as frustrating as that is for me now, I feel that because I was that person. I was that person that didn't get it. It didn't have anything to do with me or my family, and it was never going to happen to us. I didn't pay attention to what was available out there because it's just in my mind. I couldn't even fathom that it had anything to do with us. I mean, Sean's dad owned a business. I owned a business. We were both active in our community. Our kids went to nice schools. They had, they got good grades. They were really nice people. Everybody, we were really a part of this beautiful community, and we really felt untouchable as far as the things that happen, on the East Coast or the Midwest, wherever. We don't do that here in the Pacific Northwest. And very delusional, right? It seems how Oregon has one of the highest addiction rates in the country and the lowest access to treatment.
And
So,
I wouldn't think that, not that I would figure out any other state that would, but it seemed,
Well, there is a direct line highway from the border up through Oregon. So I think that that might have something to do with that.
Gotcha.
I don't know, but just a thought. Because, sex trafficking is also a, and human trafficking is also a huge issue in our state. So my reason in saying those things is because whenever I do something like this, I always have two hopes. One, I always say, and I wrote it down right here before we got on in my little journal, my Friday. I wrote a little note to Sean, please let me share your story in a way that honors you, the way you want it told, and in a way that somebody out there who's where I was back then can hear me and say it could be your child right now. So,
Absolutely.
look up. Just look, the advocates. I'm not going to think clearly right now, but the advocates that show you where to look in a child's room where they hide things. There's videos and stuff like that out there. I mean, that is so important to know. And carrying Narcan all the time for everybody is so important. Having it in your house, even if grandma takes too many of her medications, we need to have Narcan, right? It happens. So those are my hopes in sharing. So I just want to be really clear that all those things that people think about people who use substances were the things I thought I was that person. And I want that to be very clear because maybe if somebody had said that and I heard it back then, I would listen. I think that's important to admit.
Absolutely. And so brave and
Thank you.
courageous to talk about it in that depth, because there might be people who are watching us today who, they know that's them. And
Had, sorry,
that's
had
okay.
Sean Sean started using pills about between 10 and 12 years old. They would never to get like a pinpoint from him of when that first day was. Imagine, if you will, that Sean had died with the first pill because fentanyl, when he started using, wasn't really a thing. But imagine had Sean used that first, Xanax pill he took, if it had been fentanyl laced and he died. And I was that person who, one, didn't know for several years after that that my child was using. And I had so much stigma about people who do use. And I was so sure that we were so safe in this beautiful area of the country, our haven from everything, that this wouldn't touch my children. So had Sean died from that first pill, I imagine that I would have probably had a whole different narrative than what I have after we struggled with years of drug abuse and a fight for his life, that there were no resources. It's just important to me to, it's important to me to be honest about Sean's story.
Yes.
And about Sean's story and his experience, because his struggle with drug use is really where the fight was. You know what I'm saying? It's where the changes happened in all of us, and his brother and sister, and what they saw change in him, and his own struggle with being known as a junkie. And he texted me one time, and I still have it. He's like, we were, kind of going back and forth about what he was going to do with his life, and he said, "It doesn't matter anyway, Mom. I'm just another junkie."
Oh my.
So he had the stigma, the things that we say, the language we use. It's just very personal and important to me, because of Sean's experience.
Would you tell us about the day he died?
Yeah.
Where you were, where your husband was, how this all came together.
So Sean was at his dad's house. I think I mentioned that he lived in an apartment there at the house and paid rent and stuff. And he worked with his dad. So it was a Thursday morning, September 12, 2019. His dad got up to head off to work, and Sean wasn't in the kitchen, getting his lunch and stuff ready. And so dad was annoyed because we gotta go, son. We got jobs to do. And he went to Sean's apartment and was pounding on the door and, come out, time to get up, you're late. No answer. And he went back in the house and figured that Sean had, maybe was out using again, had relapsed. So he's trying to figure out what he's going to do, and he notices under the bathroom door the light is on. And so, Eureka, I found him, right? And he went to the bathroom, and Sean did not respond, and he broke the door down, and Sean had injected a lethal dose of fentanyl and had died alone on the bathroom floor. And he was pronounced, they say he died shortly after midnight, and he was found about 6 o'clock the next morning. That is Sean's dad's experience. I mean, I at that time had gotten up. It was a nice morning, nice fall morning. I had gotten my cup of coffee. I was still in my nightgown. I had gone outside. to look at my phone and, absorb the sunrise. I had put down my phone and ran in to grab something. I can't remember what it was. When I came out, back out, I picked up my phone and I had missed a call from Dan. And under that was a text message that said, "You had better call now. We've lost our son."
Oh,
And I screamed, and those of us who have experienced that, and I called him, and he was crying and saying, "Kim, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. He's dead." He kept repeating that. And he was, paramedics were there at the time we were on the phone together. I am about 3 hours from there
oh, wow.
in Salem. And so, yeah, that's how I found out. And then I came in after I got off the phone with Dan. Dan had asked me to call Amanda, my daughter. And I came in to tell my current husband that Sean had died. And I kept saying, "Sean's gone, Sean's gone." And he said, "Oh, you misunderstood. He just isn't home." And so that kind of tricked my mind a little bit into, and then I had a kind of a re a re knowing that it was true. It was true. And I called Amanda, and Amanda said, it's Amanda was on her way to work when I called her, and I said, "Honey, can you please drive back to your house? I need you to just, turn around and drive back to your house." Well, she thought that I was there, maybe they're visiting to surprise her. And she's like, "Mom, I got to go into work, you know?" And I said, "I really need you to drive back to your house and just park your car." And she did. And I told her, and she didn't believe me. She just couldn't wrap her head around that that would be true. And so she drove out. She lives very close to where Sean lived, like a half a mile.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
So she went over there and she tried to get in the house, and they wouldn't let her in the house to see Sean. The paramedics wouldn't let her in the house.
Yeah.
And so she sat there until they carried him out, and his cousins showed up too, and I think they helped carry Sean out of the house. But yeah.
I'm so sorry.
Thank you. And I couldn't process what was coming, right? So,
Sure.
the arrangements, the viewing, I couldn't really wrap my head around it, what that meant. And I know my husband said to me, I remember him saying to me, "We got to get in the car. We got to go over." And I remember Amanda calling me and saying, "What time will you be here?" And that was because the funeral people wanted to, they stayed open longer so that I
Sure.
could get there to see
Right.
Sean.
That was very nice.
That they were very good, very good. And Dan had, Sean's dad had taken care of all of that before I'd gotten there, made arrangements and all of that. And so, the family really carried me through that, because I was still, you might know a noticed a theme in our conversation. I'm in denial a lot about what's going on. And I was in denial a lot that this was real and that he was going to, I don't know. We walked in there, Amanda and I walked in together. And I just kept saying, Sean, it's okay. Sean, I'm not mad. It's okay. This is okay. And I heard Amanda next to me say, I'm pissed. This is not okay. And yeah, that we stood with him and tried to tell him goodbye. And I remember I was trying to reach for his hands, but we couldn't his his we couldn't have access to his hands. I don't know. It was really, I don't know. I don't really know what to say about that. And then Dan came in. He had given us some time, just Amanda and I. And then he came in the room, and all three of us were in there with Sean. And then we left Dan alone too. He would to be the final person to say goodbye to Sean. And yeah, that was that.
And tell us about the case.
Okay. So I think I mentioned that Sean's dad owned a landscaping business, and so he has like a lot of expensive equipment there at the house. And so he had put in security cameras on the property to kind of watch over his equipment. And so the night that Sean, I thought of one thing that I want to tell you.
Yes, please do.
The night that he died, Sean was really, really, really loved his grandma, his dad's mom, his grandma Joyce. And Sean never went to a babysitter because when he was little, Grandma Joyce always watched him. So
Aww.
they were very close. And that night before he went out to his apartment, I don't know at what point he came back into the house, but before he went to the apartment, the last words he said to anybody in our family was, I love you, Grandma. Good night. And so I just think that he,
Aww.
I just kind of felt like he wanted me to say that.
Okay.
So,
Is she
but
still with us?
yes, she
That's
is.
great.
Yeah. And so let's see the case. So Sean's dad had this surveillance equipment around the house. And so, when Sean died, the Deschutes County Sheriff's Office came on the scene, and they took Sean's phone for evidence. And Dan said, I have surveillance of the house because Sean never left the house. They reviewed the surveillance footage, and it shows that between the two things, it shows that Sean had asked for heroin. I want to be fully transparent right here. Sean had used fentanyl as a drug of choice at different points during his addiction.
Wow.
So, Sean was a poly drug user by the end. He did all of the things. This night, Sean asked for heroin. And that is what is recorded in the text messages. The dealer delivered to the house pure fentanyl.
Oh my gosh.
And Sean's dad surveillance cameras picked up when the car that delivered the drugs came to the house. It shows the exchange of money and drugs. It shows the dealer or the person who brought it leaving. And it's then it shows Sean going into the not his apartment, but the full the house, which is where he was found. So
And you mentioned before that you got the car and the license plate.
yes, on the surveillance camera, it shows the car, the license plate. It even shows the people who were there. I mean, it shows everybody's face. They left, and Sean injected the fentanyl, and he died, thinking it was heroin. Dan, the sheriff's office, Deschutes County Sheriff's Office, assured him that, they would pursue this.
What's the
And
name of the county again? The sheriff?
Deschutes County Sheriff's Office. They assured Dan that they would pursue this. They would figure out who did this. We needed to wait for the toxicology report to come back. And Dan, said, "I have all this footage, and you're welcome to that." So we waited for the toxicology report to come back. Dan took it down to the sheriff's office, and they said that Sean had died of an overdose, and they were not going to pursue it. And honestly, it's a little hard for me to remember all the details of that of what happened right at that time. But I do know that, Dan was really frustrated, but didn't know we didn't know what avenues to take to pursue it, if it was even worth pursuing. If the sheriff says it, it's the gospel. It was kind of, So we knew that Sean was purposely poisoned, that Sean was murdered. We know that, in our hearts. But there's not anybody who in law enforcement, or who is in charge of, those sorts of things, who's interested in, getting justice for families whose people struggle, because Sean did struggle with addiction for many years. And so in the end, how I see it, the message that it seems to me is that it is okay to poison somebody with fentanyl if they have been a substance, somebody who's used substances. You won't get in trouble for it. That's the message, if I don't know what to say about all of that. I know there's a lot of controversy about, between the, kind of the one pill thing, versus the supporting people who struggle with substance use. I kind of have both sides of it, right? Sean struggled, and I care about people's struggle, and I understand more now than I did before, and I want to be able to help people. My heart is with people who are struggling. And I'm really pissed off that my loved one who was struggling, it was okay to use fentanyl to murder them and never have anybody ask a question about it.
Or have no consequences whatsoever.
Yeah, there's no consequences. And so people who are using and struggling as it is to survive have this over their head as well, that their dealers, their people can murder them if they're not complying with something they want them to do, and nobody will even ask any questions about it. Because, as
And
John
also
said, they're
too,
just another junkie. Yeah.
yes, in their minds. And the DA obviously wasn't interested in trying to pursue this, even though he had all that, proof.
All that evidence. Yes. It wasn't still wasn't important enough, or there's corruption. I don't know. I don't know that. I mean, over the years, all the things play through your mind as to why somebody wouldn't want justice for the murder of somebody.
Yes.
And that's, you know, that is what it was in the end. You know, and I do know that if Sean, this is another thing that comes up, you know, if Sean wasn't struggling with substances, he never would have been in that position. I understand about the full story, about accountability, about, you know, all the things. Just because somebody struggles with a substance use disorder or uses substances does not make it okay for somebody else to murder them.
With more than a lethal dose of
Yes.
fentanyl.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. I'm sorry for your loss as well.
Well, thank you. Let's talk about your wonderful advocacy work.
Oh.
The sun is on my shadow. I have to move a little bit. The sun's coming
I
in.
always feel a little shy talking about advocacy work because I know so many powerful and amazing advocates that I've gotten to know a lot of them personally over the last 4 years. And wow, there's a lot of really strong and amazing people out there doing great work.
Of which
And
you are one.
I just
You
100%
have to get,
don't.
no. You have to give yourself credit because this wonderful woman started an organization called Dancing with Our Angels with another mother. And they have the most wonderful events. And I want you to tell us about the event where all the pictures were in a circle on the ocean, near the ocean on the sand. I saw this beautiful picture that you have to go see. I'll put it in the blog. I'm going to grab it and put it in the blog, along with pictures of Sean and his family. And please tell us how that all came together, because I think that's a lovely, that would be such a lovely event.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Dancing with Our Angels came about. I had soon after. This is an interesting connection, but soon after Sean's transition, I met a woman. A woman contacted me, also from Bend, and to let me know she had just lost her son too.
Also to fentanyl.
He was in a rehabilitation center in California at the time. I don't feel that comfortable telling his story, but she had contacted me and we connected. She's drove over the mountain from Bend to come see me. As it turns out, Sean knew her boys.
Oh my goodness.
But we didn't know each other at the time. So we really connected and she went back home after we had lunch and didn't think anything else much about it. At that time, she was writing a blog and she wrote something about the sacred dance between a mother and her angel child. And that just like stayed in my mind. I'm like, oh, how cool is that? Excuse me. That night, I had a dream and it was the beach at sunset, and Sean said, "Dance with me, Mom." And when I woke, I had an image of the Pacific Ocean, sunset, and just pictures of all of the kids and that I'd met their moms, online. And just a way of showing them that I see you, I see your child has is beautiful and has so much value, and I just felt all this love. And so I called Tanya and said, I had this dream and I got this picture and I doodled this thing. And she said, let's do it. And because she's that person, you know, I'm the dreamer and she's a let's do it person. And so we did. We went for a weekend on the coast. And we it was Tanya and I who had both lost children, and then two other ladies that we'd met at Advocacy Day who had children, both had children in active addiction. And we spent the weekend together doing healing stuff and, you know, hanging out and talking and bonding. And in the end, we took the kids' pictures and put them in a spiral. And that was Tanya's idea because the spiral symbolizes the infinity, the continuation of their story and our connection to them. And we went live on Facebook and showed all their picture on the beach and said their names. And the people who watched live on Facebook or whose children were involved, it was something kind of new for that time. Nobody was doing anything real similar to that then. And it was just a celebration of the sacred dance between parents and their angel children. And we've done it. We did it 3 years. And the last one we did in April, a woman named Alexis, who is her organization is Truth Farm, and she does the National Trail of Truth. She contacted me. Her son Jeff was a part of our event, and she contacted me and said, bring this to DC in September for the healing spaces. And so that was a big deal. That really felt like a big deal. So we did that. And I think we had almost 500 that first year. We had 111 because that was our magic sign number, and by the time we went to DC, we had almost 500
Wow.
angels. And we switched up how we did it in DC a little bit because it wasn't a weekend retreat, and it wasn't and the Hurricane Ophelia came in. I think we were in DC that day, and
Last year.
yes. So again, Tanya, who's our quick thinker, said, I have an idea, and she said, we'll make a moving spiral while the people at the event hold the kids' pictures, the loved ones' pictures. And they made a moving art piece with the photos, and it was filmed by people, you know, went live online with it, and it was very beautiful. And the wind just, at some point, the wind just swirled around as the family members are moving with the pictures of their children. So everybody's seeing everybody's kids in this spiral. The wind just picked up and moved around everybody, and they all just cheered. And it felt, I really believe in part of my being able to go forward every day is maintaining that connection with my child in spirit. It's, I don't feel like I feel sad. I'm a grieving parent. I don't feel like he's completely gone from me. I feel like we have work here to do. And I'm not sure if our work is in advocacy specifically, but I do know that it is in supporting angel parents. So.
And that job, so to speak, but that work is by far some of the most difficult to do. It's one thing to go up to Capitol Hill and talk, and that must be done big time.
Yes.
And visiting all the politicians, both at the national and state levels. But when you speak to a new mother or father, I remember being a advocate back then, and I'd have a full glass of wine ready to go when I made that phone call. because I knew it was going to be a 2 or 3 hour event, because you give space to that mother or father or sister or brother. You give them space to tell their complete story.
Yes.
Similar
Like
to what
you,
we're doing right now.
yeah, like what you're doing for me.
Right? And I always felt that that's one of the greatest gifts you can give a bereaved parent is that, because there are not many people who will listen to your complete story, right?
Yes. And I think when I have conversations with people, we call it one of two things. And if anybody follows my Facebook page, they'll see it. Soul whispers is a phrase I use usually when I'm connecting to my own angel child personally. That's kind of I'll call it a soul whisper. And but what we talk about when I have conversations with parents is creating what we call sacred space. Or
Yes.
holding sacred space. And that's how we refer to what you're talking about. Because it is exactly when a parent is ready to and feels safe enough to sit with you and share
Yep.
their loved one. I mean, there's not that many spaces for us to do that.
No, I totally agree with that. That's what I wanted to do here. I wanted to give people that opportunity because I know there's not enough of those places. And even if you go to a support group, which are very helpful, sometimes those support groups, you go and you just hear everybody's story over and over and over and over. But we're talking about when it's the first time, usually, where the parent, the mom or dad, sister or brother, or even the grandparent, if they raise the child, they don't know where to go for this. And there's so many bits and pieces of it that need to be said out loud in a safe place, you know? And sometimes it's on a public forum like we're doing now. And other times it's completely private, and no one will ever hear all the history because they don't want anybody to hear the history, and that's perfectly fine. That's perfectly fine. But when I was doing advocacy work for homicide, a lot of what I did after the fact was help them with the criminal justice system, because most people don't have a clue about what happens in a courtroom or with the homicide detectives or with the DAs. They just don't know. I mean, we don't know these things. We can't know these things. That's not our purview. And so I feel an obligation to offer that information and help.
Thank you for doing that. It's an important thing to offer.
It
It
really
really,
is. And I've very much enjoyed our time together.
Me too. Me too. Thank you.
You're welcome. Is there anything else you might like to share that came to mind?
Gosh, I don't know. I don't know.
That's okay. That's quite all right.
I think that I would like a couple of things. When early in my grief journey, there we were losing a lot of parents to suicide.
Yes, I've been seeing
And
that.
that was a big jumping off point for me as far as just reaching for people saying, you're not alone. I felt so alone in my struggle, in Sean's struggle, in our
Yes.
family struggle. I felt so alone in the right after until some of the parents started grabbing me up. I don't even remember how they did that or how they found me, but people, you know how we do. We just start
Yes.
grabbing people in those early days. And if it wasn't for those people, those parents who reached out and grabbed me up, I wouldn't have made it. I wouldn't have made it to today. I wouldn't be able to do Dancing with Our Angels. I wouldn't be here for my ch surviving children. So I just want people to know that I feel so much gratitude for our community. I see all the hard work that's being done with no compensation. People using their own money to show up to, demand justice, demand change, fight for our people who are struggling. And, currently our world, we hear so often, it's just gone to crap. Everything's bad. Money is tight. Eggs are expensive. And I think I'd like to end this interview with, I see some really amazing people, and let's just not lose sight of that.
Yes,
We're
that
going to
have
make
given
it work.
so much of their time and energy for absolutely no compensation.
Yeah.
And people don't understand what it takes to keep the fight going.
Yeah. And we need to hear sometimes that we're doing the good stuff, right?
Yep,
And it's
we're fighting the good fight,
we are. We
as
are.
they say.
Yes. Thank you so much, Mary, for having me.
Absolutely,
Really
Kim.
appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. And my friends, I just want to thank you for joining us today. And please remember to subscribe, rate, review, like, all the things you do to make this video go higher in the algorithms. It's so important on YouTube and also at the podcast, themarymaxshow.com, and on YouTube. So thank you. Most of all, please share this. We need people to just continually share this all around so we're not shadow banned. So we love you. Have a wonderful week. We'll see you again soon. Bye now.